Hey, it's the Nerdlings Podcast. I'm WC Chronicles, and we got a new guest who's going to be popping in once in a month or so. It's Greg Van Cott. Greg, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. So I'm opening the invitation to you to kind of like, you know, come do a podcast once a month. Kind of like, you're kind of like Greg, the movie TV guy.
I'm not like, I am.
Okay. Confidence there. That's what you call a confidence nerd going on there.
It's important to have confidence. Otherwise, what's the point of doing anything in life if you don't have confidence? You can't function.
Right on. So I invited you to come, and you've done a few podcasts with me before. Jersey Mike's out of town, so you were the perfect go-to guy because you actually decided to commit to it.
Yes. Is that what we're calling him now? Jersey Mike's guy? Jersey Mike's sub guy? I actually wondered if Jersey Mike, who I do like, Michael Arillo, I think he's a good guy, if he's ever walked into a Jersey Mike sub and said, I own this place, and see if anybody reacted to it.
Would it be funny if he pulled out his license and, you know, showed it that way?
Yeah, it would be a really great troll prank to just basically say that's exactly who he is. He's Mike from Jersey.
Well, he gets back. He's back visiting family. He gets back shortly. But so anyway, you're the stand-in for him in this topic of movies and TV that we're going to just kind of meander and see where we go.
Yeah, it's good to meander as long as it's fun meandering.
So I'll just throw it out. I mean, I didn't have a chance to see a lot of movies when the last 3 months of the year, but I did on my, thanks to Delta Airlines, I saw Ant-Man and Wasp Girl from the Marvel series.
Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Ant-Man, what did I say?
You said Ant-Man and Wasp Girl.
Ant-Man and Wasp Girl.
Yeah, Ant-Man and the Wasp. Is
okay, the Wasp.
No, that's all right. There's an old 50s horror movie called The Wasp Woman. So it's really bad, but maybe that's what you're thinking about too. That's actually a funny movie to talk about.
Could have been. It was a great experience to actually see that movie at 8 a.m. and just tune out the 2-hour flight.
Yeah, you should see it in 3D if you ever get a chance to see like a 3D Blu-ray. It's pretty good in 3D.
Now, that's the kind of thing, technology I haven't got to yet.
Yeah, no, that's all right. If you're cross-eyed, it doesn't help you. You won't be able to see a third dimension.
So, I mean, I really enjoyed the movie. The fact that Michael Douglas was in it.
Michael Douglas is great. Yeah, Michael Douglas is kind of in that vein of actors that... Actually, it's kind of interesting you bring up Michael Douglas. He did an interview recently with one of the many talk show hosts about how he first started as a TV actor, because he did Streets of San Francisco. But it was very hard for him to make the transition to movie actor, because at the time, when you were growing up, most people, if you were a TV actor, you got stuck being a TV actor, because TV actors were considered a lower grade, a pay grade lower than movie stars. If you were a movie star, it meant, like his father, Kirk Douglas, it meant people actually paid to see you. But because TV is free, you just were that kind of guy. You were the free entertainment versus the ones that people were paying to see. So the fact that Michael Douglas can talk about that now with a certain amount of humbleness, and that he is now at a position where people pay to see him, whether he's a lead actor or supporting actor, is pretty great. That's a cool, that's a good journey, I think, for him.
Yeah, because it seems like Guardian of the Galaxy had Jeff, what's his name?
Oh, you mean Kurt Russell was in the sequel.
Kurt Russell.
No, it's okay. They look kind of similar.
They're getting, the Marvel movies are bringing back some of the older actors from a genre long ago, and giving them a new prime on life.
Yeah. I think it's really great that the older actors can now come back, and especially they can play villains. Like Kurt Russell can play a villain, spoiler alert. He can play a villain and can do a really good job, because he mainly plays heroes. So it's great that, you know, you can flex your character acting muscles and be able to play a different character than just your typical hero all the time.
I was thinking of Jeff Goldblum, now I got the last name there.
Yeah, that's right. Jeff Goldblum also played a villain, and he was in Thor Ragnarok, and he was great in that.
Was good.
He's one of my... Jeff Goldblum is on my list. This is a funny list to have. A list of favorite weird actors. I think he's number one on my list of favorite weird actors. Others include, like, William Shatner and Christopher Walken and Johnny Depp. Like, have actors with really weird delivery. Like, they're famous for being not just weird people in general, but just weird. This is like a weird acting style. And Jeff Goldblum, because for some reason he was totally, I'm doing it right now, he was totally okay with like having this meandering, rambling quality to his acting, it worked for him to play nerds and scientists and awkward people and also villains. He does it so well. He's the number one rambling actor of all time.
He does have that kind of rambling, crazy act or villain.
See,
in the movie.
You're rambling.
Yeah,
too.
I'm kind of, I guess I.
When you start thinking of Jeff Goldblum, you start rambling.
I'm channeling Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, one of my best friends, Mac Hines, does a really good Jeff Goldblum impression. I'll have to film him one time doing it because it's true. He has kind of cornered the market in that character. Or in that shtick is what Jeff Goldblum does, you know, because he can do it in his sleep. I bet when he sleeps, he can mumble in his sleep and just be like, wonderful dream I'm having right now. This is a great dream. The ladies from my past. Very fascinating. Would you like to have some fondue? Oh yes. Sit by the fireplace. Cheese and crackers.
That would be him, yes.
Yes, that's Jeff Goldblum. Because I actually watched, I saw bits and pieces of it when I was a kid, The Fly remake from 1986.
Oh, yes.
I saw that recently for Halloween, finally all the way through. It was kind of weird that I think that movie just freaked me out too much when I was a youngling, that I never got around to watching it all the way through. And I watched the original, David Hedison. Al Hedison, he went by two names, which is interesting, two different first names, and had a transitional period where he changed his name as an actor. The original Fly with Vincent Price and Hedison from 1958, and then I had the 1986 version with Jeff Goldblum, and I watched them back-to-back, and that was really great. So it was cool to watch.
That's got to be cool to do it back-to-back, watch the movies like that.
It can be definitely for watching an original film and a remake, because... that's actually a good example of a remake that actually works and was kind of prudent to make, because I made a post on my Facebook about original films that were justified in having a remake. Not that in this case the original Fly was bad, it's a great movie. It was that you could do a different interpretation of what it means to turn into a monster. Because in the original film, it's just, there's a teleportation accident and he accidentally replaces his head and his arm with part of a fly, and in the remake he kind of slowly turns into a fly, and it's more of a metaphor for disease, and that's really cool that they could do that, and that both films say different things, and that's wonderful. But going back to, since we went full circle and went back to insects, yeah, Ant-Man the Wasp was a pretty decent sequel. I like the original more, the original Ant-Man, but I do like the sequel. It's pretty fun, and it's kind of irreverent sort of way, different from other MCU Marvel Cinematic Universe films. Like Captain America films are pretty serious, and the Guardians of the Galaxy and the Thor movies and the Ant-Man films can be a little bit more on the silly spectrum versus when you're making something as serious as like Captain America Winter Soldier is pretty serious, I would say, on the spectrum of things.
And the ending where they got the tie-in there with Thanos, the ending?
Yeah, yeah. You mean in Ant-Man and the Wasp, the tie-in? For
yes,
that,
the tie-in.
Yeah, yeah. Because you have a... Oh, yeah, because of Michael Douglas and Michelle Pfeiffer disintegrated. Yes, that... Well, that's the great thing about the Marvel Cinematic Universe is that you have the option to really homogenize everything, so different adventures are happening at different times, because people are, the great thing about the Avengers Infinity War was people were asking, where's Ant-Man, where's Scott, you know, where's Scott Lang,
where was the Fantastic Four?
they haven't quite gotten to integrating in the Fantastic Four in yet, but
I just figured they were away on a mission or something.
Yeah, they're somewhere in the Baxter Building, you know, just they're in there wondering about how to moisturize the thing, you know, how does he stay moisturized? But basically, when they disappear. But Scott's stuck somewhere in the quantum universe.
Yes.
He can be safe, supposedly, or he just wasn't picked by Thanos to disappear. That's actually interesting, because Thanos is at a vulnerable place right now, story-wise, because he got rid of half of all known life in the universe, basically for a justified reason that the world is finite as finite resources. He did it as a gesture of good in his mind, that now the other half that are all pissed off and angry at him are now going to come back with a vengeance to basically undo what Thanos did. That's essentially where the story's heading for them.
And then brings into the trailers that are arriving now for Captain Marvel.
Yeah, Captain Marvel will be fun because she's kind of the Superman equivalent in terms of abilities to fight Thanos. And that's an interesting thing because now superhero movies, and it's taken them long enough, are integrating actual female characters to be the leading characters of superhero in the superhero genre now, because it took them long enough. I mean, because unfortunately movies like Supergirl back in the 80s with Helen Slater, directed by Jeanette Schwartz, who's actually a friend of mine, not to name drop, but I'm just speaking the truth.
Go ahead.
No. It's for anybody who's listening and is like, oh, that's interesting. They basically that movie didn't work because of, actually, I would say not very good writing, but that but the attempt to try to do that back in 1984 was a novel attempt. But it's finally catching on with Supergirl being rebooted in the DC TV universe, which I think is that universe is as good as the Marvel Cinematic Universe in terms of movies. That's actually kind of interesting because the Marvel's kicking ass right now with their movies, and DC's kicking ass right now with their TV. Not so much with their movies, I would say, but at the moment. But basically, now you can have female characters with their own movies because Wonder Woman, the exception in the DC movie universe, was the best movie they've come up since the Nolan Batman movies. I would say now that they have Captain Marvel's got a movie coming out, Black Widow is supposed to have a movie coming out, this is a very good thing for...
Do you think a Black Widow movie is really going to hold up well?
No, it can, because Scarlett Johansson's really interesting, I think. I do feel sorry in the fact that a couple of her movies haven't worked nearly as well. Like, I think the anime adaptation of Ghost in the Shell that the Americans made did not work at all. Because a lot of Ghost in the Shell fans were not happy with that. And I would say that the Luc Besson-directed film... Lucy, that's a weird thing to say. The Luc Besson film called Lucy, basically, I don't think that story was all that interesting either. So, but there's interest in seeing a Black Widow film because she's just, in some ways, a leather-clad James Bond, female James Bond.
Yeah.
So you could do that. If they do it well and make it like an espionage film, that could be really cool.
Because I had my reservations on Ant-Man and The Wasp Girl. I didn't go see it in the theaters, and just by chance I happened to see it on the airplane. Mm-hmm. So it was it was better than I expected.
Well, I think for that film it worked because it was basically two characters competing for who's more badass, because Wasp is pretty badass, and yes, they made her like a stronger from the beginning, from the original movie, they made her character stronger and more equipped mentally.
The animated cartoon, she was kind of a wimp.
Well, yeah, that was the problem with earlier interpretations.
Too cutesy, too girly.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could go back and there was an argument somebody made that I really liked about how that's right. Whenever in recent movies, recent media, when a woman has a gun, a machine gun, and can take care of business and is super serious and tough, they call it the Sarah Connor effect.
Okay.
And I don't like that term because you're giving James Cameron, the credit of inventing the tough girl, which is nonsense because there's been tough women throughout history.
Yeah.
And if you want to go back before Terminator 2. Joan of Arc, she was a tough bitch. And, you know, right up till the flames, she was badass. So, but in terms of female characters in movies, you know, there were a lot of Bond girls that were pretty tough. Anya Masova in The Spy Who Loved Me, Barbara Bach's character, was actually inspiration to Scarlett Johansson's Black Widow character.
Forgive me for saying Charlie's Angels.
Yeah, Charlie's Angels.
Three tough broads.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I'm not, you know, there's no forgiveness in there at all. Those characters were pretty badass for the time. I would say that I mean, at the beginning, when Bond girls first showed up, they were kind of like sexy bimbos. They were kind of decoration to Bond. But by the time Diana Riggs' character in George Lazenby's Honor Majesty's Secret Service showed up, she was suddenly a capable girl that could defend herself, beat up another guy, successfully kill him, and she was, you know, cool about it, and, you know, she was pretty tough, and she had a really spunky attitude. When, you know, when those characters started to show up more, and they weren't necessarily damsels in distress, this is long before, you know, Terminator 2, that's when you start seeing a little bit more stronger women that were capable, I think, in films and TV. Yeah, definitely paving the way for Charlie's Angels and whatnot. But yeah, like, so there is definitely humor in a guy, Ant-Man in this case, who's a lot more awkward and goofy and silly and doesn't take it seriously, and he's pretty much being corralled by the female protagonist to, come on, take it seriously, we got work to do, and Michael Douglas sitting there basically explaining everything about how things work, and Ant-Man has got having absolutely no idea what's going on. And that's actually, in terms of storytelling, that's a good place for comedy, because I call it it's kind of a thing in Men in Black, that Will Smith is the clown character to Tommy Lee Jones's straight man, and Tommy Lee Jones knows what's going on, and there's a lot of mystery behind him, so you can play the story off as, this is Tommy Lee Jones's character Kay, and he's got a backstory, and we're finding out things about him, and Jay, Will Smith's character, doesn't really know how the Men in Black works, and how these things happen, and what's going on behind the scenes, and you can kind of teach the audience how the universe, how these things function in a very humorous way. Like, oh yeah, here's the noisy cricket, and it's tiny, and it's a small gun, and Kay's like, oh, I feel like I'm gonna break this damn thing, and but it turns out it's one of the most powerful guns.
Yeah.
And it's basically in the same function as Ant-Man. It's like, so how does this work? How does this work? How does this go again? And basically, there's humor in a guy having a slow learning curve to figuring out how all these things work. That's great for comedy.
All right, segueing into DC. Aquaman just hit $1 billion.
Oh, man.
Worldwide.
That's crazy. I have actually yet to see Aquaman. I want to see it soon because I like Jason Momoa. I really liked him in Game of Thrones. But yeah, that's... DC recently had a change in management because Zack Snyder was the creative head from Man of Steel on, post the Christopher Nolan Batman movies, when they started the DC movie universe, the DCEU. And Aquaman is interesting because Aquaman was kind of a joke.
Exactly,
for a long
time.
And they've done a really good job redressing Aquaman. So when I get around, when I get a little bit more spending money, especially after Christmas, I'll be able to see Aquaman because I do want to see it. Because James Wan, who's the director, he was the director of Saw. He started with the horror. He started with horror and slowly made his way into directing other genres like Furious 7. And so he's definitely going up in the world for an Asian American filmmaker. I think that's great. And as an Asian American, I think that's good because we have had kind of not so great representation in Hollywood throughout the years in terms of letting Asian Americans have more opportunities to either direct or act. And this is a great thing that Aquaman is a property that needed redressing. Couldn't have been the guy who was in the Hanna-Barbera era was riding dolphin.
You could not, no.
Yeah, talking to people, looking
the,
like
the
he had...
Circles
coming out of your head, looking like he had green long johns on, you know, that was an orange t-shirt, and, you know, the joke is that he come out of the water and he talked to the sea animals, and as useful as that is when he's on the land, you know?
Almost like a Dr. Doolittle thing, you know?
Yeah, it was a Dr. Doolittle thing, and it didn't seem like a very useful talent.
No.
So I'm glad that they've expanded his horizons, and I think Bruce Timm of the Batman the Animated Series era, once he got to Superman and Justice League, was able to make Aquaman look more like a guy that lived in the era of Atlantis. He had long hair, and he has a beard, and he has a big trident, and basically he's there to he looks like an old school Greek warrior.
Oh, yeah, almost Roman like.
Yeah, Roman Greek, that era. He looks like he belongs in that era, but because he's modern, he also has to have like wicked cool tattoos and, you know, just look like he's one of the guys who's there to pop a beer and eat seafood with you.
And then to the next DC trailer that's coming out here shortly, Captain Marvel, Shazam!
Yeah, yeah, the other Captain Marvel.
I think that's funny, yeah.
No, you can read it on Wikipedia. There's this really long, it's a really long property licensing dispute that happened over the years.
This is between DC
and Marvel because of the name Captain Marvel. It's different when you're talking about something like Deathstroke and Deadpool are clearly modeled after each other. I can't remember who's first in that, who created what character first in that battle, but you know, because they look very similar and have very similar names. But Captain Marvel is literally the same name. And Action Comics made, I believe Action Comics made Captain Marvel. At one time, it was more popular than Superman, which is hard to believe.
That's what I believe, because I remember growing up, the TV show version of Captain Marvel, Shazam. Mm-hmm. As silly as it was looking in the rearview mirror now, it had a lot of influence.
Well, because I think kids loved the idea that they'd say Shazam and they became a superhero.
Yeah, you know? Shazam! Yeah,
now it's kind of like, in a post big world, Tom Hanks, Penny Marshall big movie, it's still very interesting that you know, you do some magic and suddenly you're 30, 40 year old man who can take care of business, and pay taxes. Whoopee. Oh dear. The fact that, you know, Geoff Johns, going back to the change in management, is now in charge of the creative projects in DC, they can have a lot more fun, because when Zack Snyder was involved, things were a lot more dark and gritty and just like a brooding Superman, and I don't think people really were that interested in seeing a brooding Superman, because people over the years really came to like Superman for his optimism and his kind of innocence in certain ways. There's
Smallville.
Yeah, there's some similarity between Thor and Superman in that they're both kind of naive to the dark kind of gross minutia of the world. They're more interested in being a good-hearted person and, you know, having honor and doing the good deeds that need to be done. And the funny thing about doing Captain Marvel / Shazam now is that he's kind of that same thing. He's a guy that, because he's a kid, he has the kid sensibilities of doing the good deeds that need to be done. Like, you know, obviously they're going to make jokes in this new movie about him fighting bullies. So, oh, take that, bully, for making fun of me and making fun of my friends. You know, I destroyed your truck, as they showed in the trailer. I'm looking forward to that movie, definitely. I hope it doesn't suck. I think if they do it right, it will be really fun, because it lends itself like an Ant-Man, like a Thor, to being more funny than, say, yeah, Superman or Batman that need to be fairly serious.
Serious and darker.
Yeah, you can be silly and fun with the villains of Superman and Batman, but although I think some people don't like that much either in this day and age, but I think with Shazam now you can have a lot more fun with that. And I think the funny thing about the dispute is the fact that both DC and Marvel had this this thing about what they were trying to make some of their most popular brands to be. So if DC, it was, hey, it's a kid who can turn into a superhero, yay, Captain Marvel. And somehow Marvel was like, well, we're Marvel, so we're gonna have a Captain Marvel too, except that Captain Marvel, Miss Marvel, is Marvel is a woman, and she's super powerful, and she's a blonde that isn't a blonde, and that she could take care of business. And that's why now DC, who has because the Captain Marvel property of the kid that turns into a hero is basically calling him now Shazam, which was originally the Wizard. The Wizard was actually Shazam, and you say the word Shazam and you became that hero. So now they removed that name and basically he's now Shazam. So
yeah, I want to see Shazam more so than I would really care about Aquaman. I'll wait till Aquaman comes online.
Yeah, I think I noticed that there's actually a funny joke there. I hope they exploit it, which is Shazam can't talk about himself in third person because he'll turn back into a kid. Or if he's talking about Shazam, like the hero, and he's pretending...
I think he's done that in the cartoon
versions. Yeah, like he can't talk about himself. Like, he could never be a journalist like Clark Kent who could talk about himself in third person as Superman, because once he says Shazam, he'll turn into Shazam and he'll become the hero. Whoops!
And so if you're standing in water... you say Shazam, you're gonna get electrocuted.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a little bit of a problem. There's actually a really good animated film called Superman Shazam, The Return of Black Adam, which I highly recommend. If anybody wants to watch Shazam in really good animated form, modernized form, I'd recommend that movie. It's quite good. It's directed by Joaquin Dos Santos, who directed many of some of the best Avatar: The Last Airbender episodes on that animated series. Fantastic series. And Aquaman, like I said, Superman the Animated Series and Justice League did him some good justice. So that's some good Aquaman in animated form.
I think a Shazam and Superman team-up movie, or at least one of the animated features, would be really popular if they ever did that.
Yeah, they did that with... they definitely did that with that Superman Shazam animated film. They did it recently in the Justice League movie, but I haven't watched that at all either. I kind of stayed away from the Snyder films because once I saw Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice in the theater, I was pretty disappointed 30 minutes going into that movie. And I saw that movie on a discount, so I kind of saw it for the laughs and was like, oh dear. This.
I see every movie with a discount and an on sale.
No. That's being financially prudent. I don't blame you for that.
All right, another movie I saw, I don't know if you saw this one. When I first read about it, it's the movie The Meg. And I thought, what is that, some chick flick movie? I am not even going to waste my time. Then when I saw it on my carousel, the little thing spins around on the Delta airplane, it's about the Megalodon shark, I was there.
You were there, so you did see it, actually.
I did see it, finally,
okay.
Yes.
Yeah, we have the situation flipped now. I haven't seen that movie. One of my friends, Val Jason Cantrell, did not recommend that movie to me. He knows I'm a huge Jaws fan, which I assume is why you brought that up in the first place.
It has Rainn Wilson in it as the investor. Mm-hmm. He gets killed.
Love Rainn Wilson.
Has the always unshaven hero, Jason Statham.
Statham.
Statham. Well, my nose, okay.
No, it's all, no.
I'm still bad with names.
If you've never said that name in the history of your life, I can understand that. Megalodon sharks are very interesting. If you watch enough YouTube videos about them and read up on them, they are really interesting because sharks are many of the few things still in our era of existence that existed around the time of the dinosaurs.
Yeah, I mean, the success of Shark Week.
Shark Week. Assuming they're not making up stuff.
Just the popularity of it.
Yeah, no, the popularity of Shark Week. Well, sharks are...
I'm trying to plug your TV in here,
yeah,
too.
Sharks are... sharks are really interesting. I love sharks. I would love to go in a shark cage one of these days and do that. But, I mean, I'm a huge Jaws fan, so pretty much my sister, when she saw the trailer, I think it was for even 47 Meters Down, she had basically kind of said offhand, whispering in the theater, she had basically said, anytime you make a shark movie, you're competing with Jaws.
I have to agree, because when I saw it, when I watched it, I kind of felt like, this is another version of Jaws, but I'm still enjoying myself.
Yeah, well, obviously, I could tell from the marketing that movie's not meant to take itself seriously, which Jaws was meant to be mostly serious as a fun adventure with a lot of suspense. And it worked out being one of the very first major summer blockbusters that broke $100 million in 1975. It was the first movie to ever do that at the time. So Steven Spielberg making Jaws, one of his great masterpieces of filmmaking, the movie that pretty much established his career from there on, and Jaws 2 by Jeanette Schwartz, to redeem the fact that I mentioned he directed Supergirl.
Silly question, how many Jaws movies have they made?
Four,
okay.
It's a great, I would say, yeah, I mean, going back to the quality of the Jaws movies, the original is a masterpiece. Jaws 2 by Jeanette Schwartz.
What year was that?
Which one?
Jaws 2.
Jaws 2 is 1978. But Jeanette Schwartz, who later directed Supergirl, that's one of his best movies, is Jaws 2. Jaws 2 is one of the best sequels ever made. But they start to slowly, arguably, lower in quality. Because Jaws is one of the few series ever in existence that has one of the greatest films ever made in it, and one of the worst films ever made, being Jaws the Revenge, the fourth one, in it. Just slowly lowered in quality as they went on. Not to take away from Jaws 2. But the fact that it's kind of like talking about Die Hard. Because just to say this really quickly, Die Hard is one of the most ripped-off movies in the history of film, along with Star Wars.
Yeah.
There are a lot of Die Hard rip-offs, and you can't quite put the Die Hard sequels in the same place because it's still Die Hard. But so the same thing with Jaws. You can't quite say that to Jaws. And there's a lot of shark movies like Sharknado that have been made that are very terrible, but are at least made to not be taken seriously, to enjoy the terrible of it. I want to see a movie called Ghost Shark.
Ghost Shark.
There's some kind of sci-fi schlock that I'm really sci-fi channel schlock that I'm really curious to watch called Ghost Shark. That's probably for another podcast. But The Meg, I remember that it was made by a author who made a book called Meg that was really respected around the time when I was growing up. I remember people liking that book because they said it was as interesting as the original Peter Benchley Jaws book. So I think the fact that they made this movie finally, probably because of Shark Week and the success of other shark movies like The Shallows and 47 Meters Down, making a certain amount of money, The Meg, as far as I can tell, has the fact that it has like your kind of run-of-the-mill action hero Jason Statham, and it's got a very respected actor of comedy, Rainn Wilson, and it's got Ruby Rose for the millennials to to enjoy. Yeah, she's there for the millennials. She's there for us, basically. To that movie was essentially made for a certain audience that came in to not take it necessarily seriously. I'm not sure if Alden, the author of the book, really wanted that, but I think he's probably just as happy that the fact that his book got adapted into film.
I had fun watching it on the airplane flying back from Portland to Las Vegas, because I figured, all right, cool, something gory, turn it up and then bug the hell out of everybody around me.
They don't have earbuds?
Well, they have earbuds, but the gore and the, you know...
So somebody was probably...
Like Rainn Wilson, when he finally got Aiden.
Spoilers!
I rewind that part a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Just to be ornery.
Okay. Ah, you spoiled it. I wanted to enjoy not knowing Rainn Wilson got eaten.
That's your only little teaser you're going to get.
Okay, fair enough. Like I said, I you know, for me, it's all about Jaws, so... not to discourage any future filmmakers to try to make a good shark movie that is somewhere as good as Jaws, but I'll get around to The Meg eventually. It might, if I like it, it might fit into what I call the ridiculous verse movies, which are these really interesting kind of horror comedy movies that it kind of starts with American Werewolf in London in the Evil Dead movies in the 80s, and kind of slowly turns into Buffy the Vampire Slayer and the mummy movies with Brendan Fraser, that directed by Stephen Sommers movies, that basically are, here's something, it's kind of scary, you kind of take the villain, the evil force, seriously, but our heroes are pretty ridiculous, or the scenarios they're in are pretty ridiculous and absurd, and that's fun, you know. If The Meg fits in that as good ridiculous first, then I'm all for it.
And then I was wanting just to kind of skim across one of the old classic movies, because I actually had a chance when I was back visiting my folks back in Oregon. I went to the Oregon Mental Hospital, not to check in, but it's the old set of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
One of the greatest films ever made. I really love One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I was just telling Wayne here that it's one of those few movies that I really should get on DVD. I don't know why I don't. For anybody who was wondering about that tangent, I have to work later. But One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest it's actually interesting that you brought that up also, because you just brought up something. Oh, I feel like all our subjects are going full circle.
I'm
going to
tell
works.
You now, it's going to be a topic I'll be bringing up a few more times, because it was great. I have a friend who works for the state of Oregon, the State Department government. His job is to deliver documents between the different departments around the whole area.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to the Oregon Mental Hospital, not to check in, I just say that for fun. He goes there because he has to get documents to take them take these documents to the Veterans Department, take these to the Agricultural Department. So he's there about three times a day. He knows it well. I finally got to see, like at the end of the movie, where the chief is running across the field. Looks like it was filmed about 5:30 in the morning. It's dark. He showed me where that is at. I got the angle on it now and everything. It's basically a parking lot now.
Oh, jeez.
I was getting the grand tour of the whole place, but it was about 90 minutes of a chance of not raining, so I had to do it quickly. But there's a lot of things that I love going back and standing in places where things were filmed and where they were done at, like the tree that Jack Nicholson climbs into after he climbs out of the basketball court. It's still there.
Oh, great. That's awesome.
But here's the thing about it. It's since they've rebuilt the Oregon State Mental Hospital into a larger facility, you can't get to it. It's inside one of the courtyards.
Oh, it's in a courtyard. Oh, that's
yes.
That's pretty great that they kept the tree, though.
They kept the tree. And I'm hoping that my friend will be able to get somebody who works there to go take a picture of it for me. Just because nobody has seen that tree in, what, 51 years or something?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the interesting thing about that is the fact that... I know that apparently, I read up on it, that the reason why they were able to film in that very mental hospital is because the guy who ran it gave them unlimited access entire facility. So, you know, that tree was full access. But it was funny that you mentioned that the field that Will Sampson runs in is now a parking lot, because you just made me think of the song that they tear down paradise to put up a parking lot. It's like literally that's what just happened, is that shot is now a parking lot. I have another friend, James Gillette, who's works in films. He basically does the same thing. He goes to these locations, filming locations, and he tries to duplicate a shot of the movie by taking a picture of it, usually with him standing in front of it. But he tries to duplicate the frame of what the director got and puts a picture, a side-by-side comparison of it. I did that once for Jaws 2, where there was a shot of...
What did you do? Where? Tell me.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, well...
I love this kind of stuff.
Okay, well, then we'll talk about it. But when I did Jaws Fest in 2012, which is a convention for Jaws fans...
Are you kidding me?
Oh, you don't know about Jaws Fest?
No.
Okay, well, I'll have to invite you next time. But, whenever I come...
This is cool.
Whenever I go, I will completely let you in on everything. But, yes, there's a convention, and I'm not talking like the, you know, your usual Star Trek, Star Wars conventions. I'm talking about, like, there's a certain body of diehard Jaws fans that have organized on Martha's Vineyard, where they filmed the first two Jaws movies. They go there and visit Jaws locations, and they have a church there in Edgerton, which is the town on Martha's Vineyard, where they screen Jaws in a church.
In a church,
where there's this bloody violence and Robert Shaw drinking and saying terrible things to Richard Dreyfuss. Yes, there's a convention devoted to that, and there's a specific shot in the beginning of Jaws 2 where Roy Scheider is driving his police truck over to one of the jetties that's going to take him across the water to another part of the island. They did a crane shot. And at the time, during Jaws Fest, they put a scaffolding there for some seats. I'm not even sure what it was for, because I didn't see that part of the convention. But there was a scaffolding there, and basically I went up to the top, and I just, with my memory, I was able to accurately get the framing right, which
Where
I
are
thought
you?
Was remarkable. So there's actually a picture. I'm not in it, but I got the picture to be very similar to the shot that Jeanneau Short got for... when he directed Jaws 2, and that was really cool. But, yeah.
How many attendees in this Jaws convention?
Oh, there must be, there's got to be, there was at least several thousand. There was quite
a... That's a good cult classic.
Yeah,
then.
No, that was, well, yeah, I mean, that movie, there's a lot of Jaws fans. We'll go back to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest soon, which came out also in 1975.
Look, I like the Cuckoo's Nest. You like Jaws. We will probably revisit these topics every podcast, okay?
Okay, yeah. Well, I'll definitely go back to Cuckoo's Nest soon, because those two movies we're mentioning came out in the same year. I wasn't alive when Jaws came out, or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But basically, with Jaws, they've had a few conventions, and they've had some of the people who worked on that movie come on to the convention. They have yet to get Spielberg to ever show up, because that movie was so difficult for him to make at age 28 that he basically did a Douglas MacArthur thing and said, "I shall never return," when he got on a boat and left Martha's Vineyard. He had, like, he said he apparently had on the Universal Studios lot, they had the boat, Orca, the boat, Robert Shaw's boat, actually sitting there, as became later part of the Jaws ride. He would sit there on that boat when he had off time on Jaws to try to get over his PTSD for making that movie, because he would still be shaking, because he was so worried when he made that movie that the movie would just go on forever, because the animatronic shark kept breaking down all the time, so it wasn't used to the ocean bashing it all the time. And the movie was over budgeted. He was so worried he was going to get fired, and basically, he would sit there on that boat to try to overcome his feelings of just anxiety.
I heard that they did away with the Jaws ride at Universal Studios.
Yeah, they did, unfortunately.
Do you know anything new about that?
Well, there's still some piece of it. At least I know in Hollywood. I don't know about Florida. I think they mostly removed it in Florida. I think they replaced it with some... I don't want to... Don't quote me on it, but I feel like that seems like one of the things that Harry Potter would, like, take over that space, or Fast and the Furious would take over that space. But in Hollywood, and I was just there for Thanksgiving...
Universal Studios?
Universal Studios Hollywood. I was just there a couple days before Thanksgiving of last year, of 2018, that they still have a piece of the Jaws ride when you go on the backlot tour. So they still have the robotic shark, and it pops up near the caravan, or whatever you call that, going by. And basically, the shark pops up, and the little scuba guy dies, and blood bubbles up, and it gets electrocuted, you know, Jaws 2. You can't explode it like Jaws 1, but you can explode it, you can electrocute it like Jaws 2.
Yes.
You can kill Bruce that way, but basically Bruce is the name the Spielberg called the shark when he made Jaws, because he named it after his lawyer. But
that makes sense.
But the ride still exists. But Jaws Fest is great, because if you're lucky, you could go on a boat, a real boat, and go to some of the spots in Nantucket Sound where they actually filmed. Like, I don't know how somebody figured that out. Somebody must have GPSed it. But they basically found the area where they were on the boats filming that movie, where the shark was floating, where the shark was on the gimbal going underwater and rising and, you know, popping up near the boat and moving, circling around it, all that sort of stuff. They kind of figured that out, because Jaws fans are just that nerdy.
Much like the boat that was used in the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest filmed at Depot Bay.
Yeah, yeah.
I cannot find the exact information about if that boat still exists or not.
Well, that's the thing about boats. They're really hard to maintain.
The name changes, you know, it's something I'm still digging on. But that Depot Bay, I remember going there camping with my parents as a kid on the Oregon coast, and I didn't even realize it at the time what I was doing and where I was at.
Yeah, I know that apparently a lot of the people, except for Jack Nicholson, got seasick on that boat sequence.
That's what I heard and read.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think the greatest thing about that movie is it's on one of those... It's not a very large list compared to other movies, but it's on a list of movies that established the careers of several actors.
So many!
After that. Because not only did, you know, Jack win the Oscar for that movie, his first Oscar, but you're talking, like, Christopher Lloyd is on that movie,
Danny DeVito's
on that movie, and
Michael Douglas producing.
Back to Michael Douglas, he produced it, because his father, Kirk Douglas, bought the movie rights to that book because he wanted to play Jack Nicholson's part. He wanted to make a movie of that, but it took too long for like 15 years once he bought it to get to...
I didn't know that. 15 years?
Yeah, it took him about 15 years. His son ended up really getting... because he starred more as a producer in some ways than he was as an actor, to get that movie made, which is interesting because Jack Nicholson... Michael Douglas had to convince his own father that, "Dad, you're too old to play this part," because in the book he's much younger.
Yeah,
in the book, the play, he's much younger, so you need to let it go, and eventually he did, so that paved the way for Jack Nicholson. But yeah, I mean, you know, Jack and Chris and Danny and Brad Dourif and Louise Fletcher won the Oscar playing Nurse Ratched, and Will Sampson, be good for Native American actors that he ended up getting that part. So it's one, like what I said, one of those movies where a lot of actors got established doing that movie and found other work pretty quickly, especially in the 80s. You know, all those guys I just mentioned were like, their careers exploded in the 80s, you know? I mean, Christopher Lloyd and Danny DeVito were both on Taxi, so that ended up working out
that
well for them, too.
Well.
There's a show I've not watched one episode of, but I just know that fact.
Well, there's your homework. Wrapping up the podcast here in our final moments, I have to say, the movie I'm looking forward to is Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
The DC one.
The Shazam one. Shazam, yeah, one. Yeah. That, no, because that's up your alley. That you like comedy, and that's your thing. So, I know, I look forward to that because I also like the lead actor. I feel like the lead actor, because he's not that buff, was clearly put into a suit to make him look like his muscles got enhanced. So that's actually very funny to me. I'm looking forward to that movie. I'm not also that familiar with that director, otherwise I'd be able to remember his name right now. But no, I think it looks like the young cast for that movie is really great, and they got Jamon Hansu to play the wizard, which I love Jamon Hansu. I've loved him since he was in Amistad.
It's
going to
be a whole new storyline on it. It's gonna be
no,
cool.
Yeah, no, because there's so much you can do with that, actually, because you could really play up just the idea of a hero that, because he's so young, he doesn't really have the understanding, or you could say he doesn't have the cynicism of an adult to really get in the way of doing what he's supposed to be doing.
Yeah, we'll get 10 reboots like Spider-Man.
Oh, gosh. The reboot thing is always something that's a subject of contention as far as I'm concerned, but that's for another podcast.
All right, Greg Van Cutt, our movie TV guy, you got an open invitation. You know, every month, come join me and Mike and just conversate this, because it always leads to just one thing to another for nerding out on.
Yeah, that would be funny to have Mike in on it.
It'll happen.
Saying his joysy things, but and you have an open invitation to the next Jaws Fest whenever that happens, so.
I think that'd be so cool. It sounds interesting.
Yeah, the thing, you know, just make sure you have enough money for your lodging and the food, because it gets
pricey.
That's
where there's a short end.
Yeah, that's where it gets pricey, because it's basically like a version of Disneyland for movie nerd geek guys.
All right, well, thank you for being on the podcast, Greg. While Jersey's out of town, thank you so much.
Yeah, he's probably eating a sub, but thank you very much for having me. I don't mind talking about this. I can talk about this in my sleep, which I probably do.
That's why I want you on the podcast. You got knowledge more than most people.
Oh, well, I try not to be with most people, but that being said, you know, be unique, be different, be out of the box, everybody.
Be a nerd. Have a good evening, everyone.
Love you, my peeps.